Let's call the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Let the record reflect it's 1:38 on this Thursday, April 1, 2010. We do have a quorum. To my far right, Senator Meyer. To my immediate right, Senator Thomas and myself, Senator Pascvan. The purpose of our meeting today is threefold. Senate Bill 38 will be the first bill that we will bring before us. It relates to pharmacy benefit managers, managed care, and is my intent to hear this bill today and set it aside for additional consideration. Next, we will bring up the Model Entity Transaction Act. It is also my intent to hear the bill today and then set it aside. And then lastly, Senate Bill 303 relating to workers' compensation and contractors. It is my intent to move that bill today if it is the will of this committee. So we'll, I guess, get started and welcome Senator French to the Labor and Commerce Committee. And if he would be so kind as to state his name and affiliation and present the merits of the bill.
Will do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Hollis French. I represent West Anchorage in the State Senate. I am here today to give you a first hearing on SB 38, Pharmacy Benefit Managers. With your indulgence, Mr. Chairman, since this is the first hearing, I'd like to read into the record the sponsor statement and then turn the hearing over to folks who know way more about this matter than I do. SB 38 would regulate and bring transparency to the business practices of pharmacy benefit managers in Alaska. Pharmacy benefit managers are the largely unregulated drug middlemen that administer the prescription drug benefit portion of health insurance plans for governments, private companies, and unions. The three major pharmacy benefit managers are Medco, CVS Caremark, and Express Scripts. Wells Fargo Insurance Services, the state of Alaska's health insurance provider, has a contract with Envision Pharmaceutical Services to administer prescription drug benefits for state employees. Pharmacy benefit managers, otherwise known as PBMs, negotiate with drug manufacturers and pharmacies on behalf of health insurance plans. These negotiations include cash rebates that drug manufacturers pay for drugs placed on lists of approved drugs. The confidential and proprietary nature of these contracts and financial arrangements with drug manufacturers and pharmacies creates the opportunity for pharmacy benefit managers to engage in unfair business practices. PBMs increase profits by accepting incentives from drug manufacturers that are not shared with health plan sponsors, such as the state of Alaska. SB 38 would prohibit PBMs from intervening in the delivery or transmission of prescriptions. At the beginning of 2009, 29 states and the District of Columbia have sued Express Scripts and won, resulting in a settlement of $9.3 million to states and up to $200,000 to affected patients in as of May 2008. 28 states and the District of Columbia have sued CVS Caremark and won, resulting in a settlement of $41 million in February of 2008. The federal government and 20 states have sued Medco and won, resulting in a settlement of $184 million in 2006. The lawsuits were filed under the Federal False Claims Act and or state false claim acts and or statutes. In addition to lawsuits against PBMs, 16 states as well as the District of Columbia have enacted laws that regulate the business practices of PBMs. Other states have led the way with legislation regulating the business practices of PBMs, and it is time for the Alaska legislature to do the same. I'll just close by saying that behind me is my staffer, Kristen Peterson, who's worked very hard on this bill, both with the former senator from Juneau, as well as in my office. She carries an enormous body of knowledge forward from that office to mine. I'm thankful for her help in preparing this bill for your presentation. And with that, Mr. Chairman, I will be happy to take questions.
Does anyone on the committee have any questions for Senator French or his staff, Christine Peterson? If not, I think we'll just get into the...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I know there's many. I just say there's people here that know way more
about this than I have. All right. Barry Christensen. And we need for each of you to state your name and affiliation, and then please present your testimony? And is Dirk White, I assume?
That's
okay.
Correct.
Just want to make sure.
You bet. Thank you, Senator Pascin. And thank you for the opportunity to hear this bill. And we'd also, but for the record, I'm sorry, for the record, my name is Barry Christensen. I'm a pharmacist. I'm also co-chair of the Alaska Pharmacists Association. And then I'll let Dirk go ahead and introduce himself.
And for the record, Dirk White, and I'm just an average working pharmacist. I don't normally dress like this, so this isn't my Southeast attire. With my pharmacist wife and I, we operate two pharmacies in Sitka with over 30 employees. And I'm also a member of the State Board of Pharmacy and, as Barry said, a member of the Alaska Pharmacy Association.
So the record is always clear. If you could, at the beginning, if you're going back and forth, try to identify who you are, so then the record is clear as to which of the two of you is making any comment.
Sure, you bet. For the record, again, this is Barry Christensen, and I will be doing, we have a short presentation here. I'll be doing the first half, and Dirk will be doing the second half. Once again, Senate Bill 38 is that you have before you is has been the priority for our association, the Alaska Pharmacists Association. And our membership makes up pharmacists, pharmacy technicians, and other individuals practicing pharmacy in the state of Alaska. So our members work in community pharmacies and hospitals and in other government institutions and in places like the Pioneer Homes. There are many good reasons to support Senate Bill 38, so we'll go ahead and get rolling on that. First, maybe just a real brief summary of what PBMs are. Senator French alluded to it, but PBMs, the acronym for Pharmacy Benefit Manager, Pharmacy Benefit Managers are PBMs, and they act as intermediaries between the individuals, or the patients, the plan sponsors, pharmaceutical manufacturers, and pharmacies. We're the point of the sale, but we're also involved there. PBMs can and do use their large purchasing power to negotiate rates for members, and ideally that passes those lower costs on to consumers. They do this. One way of doing it, they do this is by managing formularies, so which drugs they can best obtain the best pricing from the drug manufacturers. This next slide, and I hope you can see it okay, it's just kind of a diagram of how the supply chain for pharmaceuticals or prescription drugs works in the United States. As you can see, the pharmacy there is in the middle. The consumer is at the top. So most of us are familiar with the situation where the patient comes in, presents it to the pharmacy, pharmacist, they fill the prescription, they pay their share or their copay, and that's it from what the patient sees. On the back side, as you can see, the pharmacy has to procure their product from somewhere. In most instances, in a community pharmacy setting, it's from the drug wholesaler or distributor, which is on the right-hand side. And then the drug wholesaler or distributor actually buys that product from the drug manufacturer. On the left side, you can see this is where the pharmacy benefit manager fits in. They have contracts with the drug manufacturers to basically recoup some of the, some rebate money back on the other end, and that's evidence there. And in turn, the pharmacy benefit managers have contracts with both the pharmacy and the employer or health sponsor regarding the payment of the prescription drugs. Lastly, of course, the last diagram up in the upper left hand is the consumer, and premium dollars either paid directly by the consumer or by the employer for the consumer. So what's the problem? Why are we here? Why are the pharmacists in Alaska concerned about PBMs? The industry has been largely unregulated for the last 10, 15 years, and as such, it's grown quite a bit. Part of the reason why they've grown quite a bit is they've been able to charge more for their drugs than the pharmacies actually receive for payment from distribution to the patients. One of the other ways PBMs make money is by operating large mail order operations and switching patients from one drug to another, sometimes more expensive perhaps for the patient, but a larger rebate on the other end, and therefore, again, making more money for the PBM. This slide just indicates what Senator French indicated is that there's three large PBMs operating in the United States. All of them operate in Alaska. This last slide indicates they've had some extremely nice profits in this decade. Last decade, I should say. Senator French also referred to some of the problems with fraud and deceit, and mentioned three of the big PBMs in the lawsuits. This slide just basically indicates some of the actions that brought those lawsuits about. So the question is why transparency? And actually, maybe the slide should say, why not transparency? Because without the plan sponsor knowing what the actual cost of the drugs that they're purchasing for their members cost, it's very difficult. It would be very difficult for them to negotiate a good contract with the plan sponsor. And with that, I will go ahead and turn the second part over to Dirk.
Yes, thank you again for the record. This is Dirk White from Sitka. And yeah, so why just stay the same? Why would we want to impose? So some of the opponents of transparency would say that this is going to allow the PBMs or the drug manufacturers to have some collusion going on. They could then inflate the pharmaceutical prices. Manufacturers, of course, would say that they'd be reluctant to give the discounts if that information and the dollar amounts are actually out there in the public and disclosed. And once that drug pricing is made available, then the pharmacy benefit managers would have far less power in bargaining. And of course, so far what we've seen in other states that have passed this legislation, these haven't proven to be true. So how does this transparency make such an impact on our savings? Well, PBMs make an enormous amount off the rebates and those fees, and we're not even, the plan sponsors aren't even aware, the state and employers like myself. I don't even see where that money is. The PBMs can upcharge plan sponsors an average of $23 more for a prescription. In other words, what I get paid for, they'll take that and add another $23 onto it, and then they end up charging the plan sponsor, which would be like the state of Alaska or a union. So then how does the transparency make such a huge impact on savings? Well, pharmacy benefit managers have a financial incentive to encourage the use of more expensive brand name drugs because they get a higher rebate or other incentives to push those particular drugs rather than less expensive generic drugs. And without transparency, the rebates that PBMs negotiate are not necessarily passed on to the plan sponsor, which would be the state of Alaska or, like I say, a union, because we don't know what those dollar amounts are. So if we don't know, how are we going to ask for them? With transparency, we'd be able to understand that they're there. The next slide shows some of the major savings that other states have seen, $50 million in New York, $1.1 million on a $3.6 million budget that Lear Corporation saved. Sheet Metal Workers International Association saved up to 30%. TRICARE anticipates saving $1.67 billion by negotiating its own drug prices. 23 states have so far enacted this legislation, and South Dakota being one of those, they saved $800,000 in a single year. And Wisconsin, $30 billion. Texas estimates $265 million. California Healthcare Coalition, they found that their transparent PBM could save them $3 to $6 on every prescription. And on a per capita basis, of course, that's a substantial savings for California. This is an example, an Alaskan example, that's actually, we have the facts on it, the data on it, and person filled the prescription, the member's copay, the beneficiary's copay was $37.50. That was 20% of what the state was billed The state was billed $187.50 by the pharmacy benefit manager for a 90-day supply of blood pressure medication. So $37.50 went to the pharmacy, and $150 went to the pharmacy benefit manager. Over a year of filling this prescription, the state paid the pharmacy benefit manager $750 for just this one prescription. $150 went to the pharmacy, $600 went to the pharmacy benefit manager. So who actually did the work? The pharmacist filled the prescription, made sure that the patient was compliant with the medication, followed the medication, knew what the side effects were, dealt with the patient on a regular day-to-day basis. They got paid $150 over the year. The PBM got paid $600 for flipping a switch. And the state was overcharged, because that's a lot more than we would have charged for that prescription normally. So what will Senate Bill 38 do for Alaska? It'll level a competitive playing field for us local pharmacists, ma and pas that are out there in dealing with pharmacy benefit managers. Protects patients from unauthorized drug substitutions by the pharmacy benefit managers. It's going to provide some pricing transparency, saving plan sponsors, the state of Alaska, our unions, and small ma and pas that are trying to provide health care ourselves and our patients money. Thank you very much. Appreciate you listening to the Barry and Dirk show here. And Jerry Purcell is also going to give testimony, and he's even more knowledgeable on some of these things that are going on than we are, because we're trying to fill prescriptions and take care of our patients, and we don't see a lot of this or are able to analyze this stuff. So he may be able to answer some of the questions that you've come up with better than we could. So after he's done, maybe we'll be here for further discussion. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the PBM actually never touches the drug. They don't do anything in that process. They're simply a, I'm not sure if it's a necessary part of it, but they are an entity that actually just is supposedly negotiating a better price for you, but at an extreme benefit for themselves as well. In all cases, basically, or almost anything, and the transparency would be to make sure that people at least have the ability to know exactly the entire transaction that's taking place in bulk form, maybe to a union or to a state or to a corporation, versus the idea of you don't know, you make some kind of arrangement with them because they say they're going to do good things for you, and ultimately you end up paying that entity that is the insured, or the say the state or the union or whatever, just ends up paying all of the bills and without any real knowledge of exactly how the money is being parceled out.
Yes, through the chair, Senator Thomas, yes, that is correct. They own no inventory. They have no stock whatsoever in the pharmaceuticals that we dispense. I purchase my pharmaceuticals from my drug wholesaler. I pay the bills for those medications, and then I get paid like that $37.50. Either that particular case was a copay, so the patient actually paid that. In some cases, there may be that copay plus a little bit of money that is then sent to me through the pharmacy benefit manager's system. And then they turn around and upcharge that, is essentially what happens, for flipping a switch.
And was somebody going to explain the difference between them and a third-party administrator? Is there still a third-party administrator involved in this? I didn't, went through it rather quickly, so I didn't get back to your chart that shows the flow of things, so I didn't know if there was a, it shows somebody between the consumer, the employer, the pharmacy benefits me. That's kind of a confusing little chart to me as I was trying to follow the lines around to see the flow of the money, which was the important part.
Senator Thomas, through the chair, this bill would actually make the PBM ATPA. Currently, they're not, so the plan sponsor would be considered the TPA.
Okay. Thank you.
Question that I have, you talk about mail order pharmacies distinct from the type of work that you do, and inflated prices relating to repackaging. Could you more precisely explain what you mean by that?
Again, this is Dirk, Chairman. Through the, since his chart is back up here again, well, it was. What we've seen, and when this is going to get confusing, every prescription bottle has what's called a national drug code on it, and that national drug code, the first set of numbers is significant, like the first four to five numbers on that sequence is significant of who the manufacturer is and or packager of that prescription. The second set of numbers, again, another series of four or five dash between them, is specific to that product. In other words, it would be penicillin 500 milligram tablets. Then the last one or two numbers after the hyphen signifies the package size. So if I had a package size that I'm buying from my wholesaler of, say, 28 tablets, which is a unit of use that we would dispense, you take one tablet four times a day for 7 days, that's 28 tablets, that would have a specific national drug code number on it. Well, every national drug code number has an AWP, which is average wholesale price, that's assigned to it. Now, the person that packages it or manufactures it puts, they get the NDC number, and with that NDC number, then they put the average wholesale price. Well, in mail order houses, what we found is that the NDC numbers are from repackaged. They could buy a train load of, say, that penicillin 500 milligram tablets from the manufacturer, and then they'll repackage it into those same small little 28 count bottles, the unit use bottles. They'll apply for their own average wholesale price, the AWP price. But my AWP price that I can buy from my wholesaler, which is AmerisourceBergen, maybe $10, say, let's just use that as a figure. Their assigned AWP price could be $100. So when you say AWP is AWP, here you have two of the same bottles. Each of them have 500 milligram penicillin tablets in them. This one I bought from my wholesaler for $10. This one, they're repackaging and saying that its wholesale price is $100. So when they discount the price, they could discount 50% off $100, and they're still going to make a whole heck of a lot more money than I would make if I dispense that at my usual and customary price. That answer the question?
I think we're getting there, but the record should reflect that we've been joined by Senator Davis, and we welcome her today.
Thank you.
Is there an ownership overlap between any of the mail order pharmacies and the PBMs?
Mr. Chairman, the best of my knowledge, there usually is. The pharmacy benefit managers do own a mail order house. I'm not aware of any that don't, but I'm sure there probably are.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know all of the companies, but the best of my knowledge, yeah.
Is it the potential at that level to provide a discounting to the mail order pharmacy that you never have access to that pricing? Is that where part of the problem arises, where they can buy in volume essentially from themselves if they are the producer supplier?
Mr. Chairman, yes would be the simple answer. And of course, if, say, we took Medco, it was owned at one time by Merck Sharp Dohme, which is a very old established pharmaceutical company. They would have access of raw materials from Merck to make the tablets, capsules, whatever it is, whatever the dosage form is, and then move it to their mail order house. And from the mail order house, it would move to the consumer. So they would have direct line from raw materials to final consumer, and then they would have the control loop for the cash flow as well.
And I guess what I want to focus on is the potential for manipulation of pricing as compared to your business. In other words, you can't buy directly from any of the pharmaceutical companies. I assume you have to buy through intermediaries. And, you know, so that's where I'm trying to understand better on the pricing disadvantage that you would have.
Senator Paskin. Right. There, I guess there's two separate... Sorry, for the record, Barry Christensen. I guess there's two separate pricing issues, if you will. There'd be the acquisition, that is what it cost for the drug, and then there's this other figure that's out there called average wholesale price. It's the manipulation of the average wholesale price that I believe has been the biggest problem. There certainly are costs, there certainly could be cost savings to be had from mail order firms buying larger volumes of certain drugs. But again, the I think the larger factor is the AWP issue that Dirk White explained earlier.
Can I add to that?
Certainly.
Mr. Chairman, yeah, and you'd asked about direct purchases. Up until probably about 1995, thereabouts, my wife and I had contracts to buy direct from Letterly and Lilly and Merck, and so we were able to save. The reason we were doing those direct purchases was because they were paying the freight, and that was saving us about 2% on our bottom line, and that was an advantage for us. Then pretty much I don't know of a single drug manufacturer anymore that will sell to an independent mom-and-pop pharmacy anymore. So we are having to go through an intermediary, our drug wholesaler, like AmerisourceBergen, or there's McKesson is another one, and then Cardinal. Those are the three national drug wholesalers that sell to us mom-and-pop type pharmacies.
Right. So now the business structure is the pharmacies have to go through the PBMs. Is that...
Senator Paskin, I'm Barry Christensen again. Yeah, definitely what we've seen in the managed care world, you know, since probably the early 90s is more and more prescriptions being processed through the PBM networks. I think nationally it's somewhere between 85 and 90%.
And I guess just as a follow-up to that, what is the risk to the individual pharmacist if they complain about the PBM pricing structure, you know, the whole issue of retaliation for, you know, you have some examples in here that maybe raise some eyebrows. So what is have you heard nationally or in Alaska as far as the PBMs exercising their superior economic resources?
Senator Paskin, yeah, I mean, I got to say, it takes. I guess I'll say it takes guts for Dirk and I to be up here, in a sense, because we're just little Alaskan independent pharmacies, and they do carry you know a lot of weight, and pharmacies in Alaska and the lower 48 are always subject to what are called audits. This bill addresses that. There's been some real really heavy hands with regards to audits. In particular, the bill addresses the fact that sometimes PBMs ask for greater, they ask for things to be on a prescription that by under state law doesn't have to be. Let's just say a doctor's license number, for example. Get back to your question. Yeah, they have a heavy hand.
Okay. Any further questions? Seeing none, we thank you too. We will. You are welcome to stay there. I believe the next person is Jerry Purcell. Is he online?
Mr. Chairman, this is Jerry Purcell from Atlanta.
Thank you. We can hear you. Please provide your testimony.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and ladies and gentlemen of the committee. I am here today representing my company, which is called Pharmacy Partners. My name again is Jerry Purcell. That's Jerry with a G for the record, and I'm here to support SB 38. I am testifying without any compensation on behalf of, in support of SB 38. Just in the way of very quick background, this has been an area of expertise for me nationally for about 15 years, the first 5 years working as a national sales director for a PBM that conducted a number of contracts or worked through a number of contracts with state and taxpayer entities. For the last 10 years, I've been recognized as a national functional area expert on PBM practices. I have personally briefed over a dozen states' attorneys generals, both in blue states and red states. I have testified and typically do testify some 3 to 5 times annually before committees such as the Senate Labor and Commerce Committee. I've done extensive work throughout the states in reviewing state contracts, and in particular, a great deal of work in the state of Texas most recently, and I understand that Texas was mentioned particularly for the multi-million dollar, $265 million savings. I have a unique level of understanding as to how they arrived and the various transparency triggers that they put into place through legislation and contracting. And in fact, I would just make a note that that $265 million in savings is only one of 4 Texas state plans. So by the time they have fully implemented their transparency bill, the savings will likely exceed $500 million. And understanding this industry, ladies and gentlemen of the committee, the problem has been historically that there has been great mystery in understanding the complexity of PBM practices. Literally, in the late 90s, PBMs had 30 to 40 different ways of making money, and only a very few of those ways were actually disclosed to the clients. And part of the problem has to do with the incentive, the way the incentive structure is based in this particular industry. PBMs or managers, as they call themselves, actually make money when the client's costs go up. So it is sort of a reverse, some people even call it a perverse incentive, because they really are not incentivized to truly manage the cost of the plan typically, but in fact make more money as the plan costs go up. My efforts have been in creating environments where transparency is required, and in every situation, and I know you had some examples, it would be very unusual for me to go into any situation where there is a lack of transparency and not be able to save that taxpayer entity somewhere between 10 and 25% off of their first year drug expenditures. And obviously with state budgets, that becomes increasingly important, those savings, and oftentimes is into the millions and even the billions of dollars. There are 4 areas, and very quickly I will point out that I really like, and I like all of SB 38, but 4 areas very quickly. The first one is registration. I think the idea behind registration is not to punish PBMs, but it's to simply put them on a level playing field. Every other medical and healthcare industry in your state and in most states, including insurance companies, third-party administrators who administer both medical, dental, and other types of benefits, dentists, optometrists, pharmacists, certainly physicians I mentioned, all of those entities are required to register. The only exception in many states, however, is the pharmacy benefit manager. So in requiring them to simply register just levels the playing field, and they do fit the classic definition of a third-party administrator. While TPAs do different things, some of them process dental claims and vision claims, some of them purely medical claims, some of them other types of ancillary benefits, their core functionality is that they do process claims and they do administer the payment of claims. And so in that sense, the pharmacy benefit manager is no different from any other type of TPA who provides that core functionality. The problem that we have had, the challenge, is I have briefed attorneys generals all over the country, is that we don't, in many cases, we don't know how many PBMs are even operating within a state. And if you ask different experts how many PBMs are operating in the United States, they will give you answers that range between 80 and most recently I saw an estimate of in excess of 230 different PBMs. And so we want to get a handle on how many are operating within the state. So if there are problems down the road, if there is litigation, as we have seen, over $500 million worth of litigation over the last 3 to 4 years, most of it went without a verdict, but almost in all to the payer or to the consumer. So I'm very pleased to report there's been great success in these litigation efforts, but we first must identify who is out there that is providing these services. Secondly, the area of disclosure, and you've heard some discussion, I won't belabor the point, but I will give you one example. Before the 27 state attorney general settlement occurred in 2003, we did not have any idea how much money the PBMs were retaining in the way of rebates. After that settlement, though, we learned that they were retaining over 55% of the rebate dollars. Now, when you think about a rebate, you know, the classic Black's Law Dictionary definition of a rebate, something that inures to the benefit of the payer. But in this scenario, those benefits were inuring primarily and in the majority to the middleman. And it was really a classic arbitrage scheme because they were taking your money or the payer's money, and they were leveraging it without great expenses or infrastructure costs or any of those things, and they were leveraging it for high margins and then retaining the majority of those margins without disclosing, in some cases, even the nature of the margin and certainly not the amount. So what this bill does, SB 38, is it just makes sure that the state of Alaska will continue to benefit from total disclosure, not only of rebates, but of other types of things like spread pricing. And you had an analogy given on AWP and how that can be used to create spreads. Spreads also occur in rebates in retail spread, where the PBM may be charging you a number, but reimbursing your local pharmacies a different number and keeping the difference. Well, we think because that's your money that you ought to at least be aware that it's occurring and that you ought to be aware of the amount of money that's impacted. New Jersey is a good example, a recent example of where they had a no-bid contract in place for many, many years. And in taking that bid out to contract and putting some transparency requirements in it, they're going to be able to save $500 million over 5 years, $100 million a year. The third thing, and I have just two left here, the third thing is in the area of pharmacy audits. The practice of extrapolation, and if you don't understand extrapolation, I'll try to give you a layman's definition. Essentially, extrapolation occurs if you go into a pharmacy to audit them. If you're a PBM and you go in and audit them, and you find a single prescription that was administered wrong, and oftentimes it is not a clinical or medical or prescribing error. It may be as simple as an administrative error where the prescription form is, there's something omitted from it. It may have the wrong dosage on it. Now, there was one example in Texas, and that is actually a state senator in Texas who was a dispensing pharmacist who dispensed a prescription of ibuprofen incorrectly. And it was an 800 milligram prescription for ibuprofen. The PBM in this case went back 5 years and identified every ibuprofen prescription and charged that amount, and it was about $8,000, charged it back to the pharmacist on the next invoice without any appeals process in place at all, and no statute of limitations. And I'm talking, when I say going back, it is not uncommon for these audits to go back anywhere from 4 to 7 years. They are often done without notice. They are almost always done without any meaningful appeals process, meaning if the pharmacist objects to it, there is no time frame for which they have to respond to it before they already go ahead and take the money out of the account, and it's usually on the next cycle. So what this bill does is it corrects that problem. Extrapolation, in my judgment, is not a procedure that should be allowed. Every claim should stand on its own merit and should be audited as such on a by-claim basis. Nobody argues that, but we do have a problem when they make an assumption, and that assumption affects up to 5 to 7 years of business for every identical or similar type prescription. Sometimes the word retaliation was used as it relates to pharmacy audits. I could share for probably several hours anecdotal examples of exactly that type of practice, or what would appear to be at the surface some type of retaliation when guys or pharmacists, local pharmacists, go go up and testify, or they complain, or they write letters. It is not uncommon for them to show up on an audit list. And audits in this economy are on the increase. And again, the local pharmacists have very little protection that would be normal in other industries. They have very little of those same or similar types of protections. The fourth thing, this is the closing one, is the issue of timing of prices. Prices change. Prices are very dynamic in the drug manufacturer marketplace, as in other industries. Often, these price updates occur literally every night, and typically PBMs receive downloads from data sources that update those prices. The problem over the last decade is that oftentimes they will make the change in the price to affect the payer, but they won't make the change at the same time to affect the provider, pharmacy, thereby creating arbitrage or a spread that's hidden. Now, the net effect of this over a year's period of time, as you can imagine, even though you may be talking about pennies worth of difference, it literally adds up, and we're talking about millions of dollars of arbitrage activity. And all we're saying here is that the timing should be close to identical, and I think the bill costs for 24 hours. But that just eliminates one of those spread practices, and it is one of the 40 different ways that they've enjoyed high margins and profitability. And my argument, it has nothing to do with their profitability. They do have the highest operating margins in healthcare. It is disproportionate to any other industry, typically in the 40 to 65% adjusted operating margins. But the problem is not the profitability or the margins. The problem is how they arrive at it. And they arrive at it typically with your money. So SB 38, I fully support. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have. And I think it will go a long way towards making Alaska a best practices state in terms of its PBM contract.
Thank you, Mr. Purcell. Any questions by any committee member? Senator Thomas.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your testimony. You indicated they have some of the highest margins. I thought the pharmaceutical industry had some of the highest margins of profit. But you say these folks have even a greater percentage?
Well, Senator Thomas, via the chair, you're absolutely correct in the interpretation of my statement. Pharmaceutical manufacturers typically will make somewhere between 14 and 18%, and that would be a very healthy year for them. A typical Blue Cross Blue Shield plan would be satisfied with anywhere from 4 to 6%. But when you talk about PBMs, you have the outlier, and they generally are going to operate with adjusted margins of somewhere between 40 to 60-65%. Much of that, and I should point out because the question of mail order was raised, much of that comes from mail order. In fact, about 55% of their total margin is driven from mail order. So you can see, you can begin to see a pattern of inherent conflict. Obviously, they are going to want to do things to drive traffic away from retail businesses by using different average wholesale price mechanisms or different packaging mechanisms that would certainly disadvantage the local pharmacy and would highly advantage them to drive higher margin. Every time they move a retail script over to a mail order script, there's a 10 times exponential factor in terms of their margin. So when you put that together, specialty drugs is another big area of concern of ours too, because it's the fastest growing, and you know, PBMs not only own their own mail order facilities typically, they also own their own specialty mail order facilities, and those drugs and those margins are even higher with a typical retail of about $2,000 per drug and typically a margin of $400-$500 per prescription.
Follow up, Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Was there no attempt in the new U.S. health care plan to curb some of this activity or have some kind of impact on this? And if there had been, do you have any estimation of what, absent that even happening, if there was more state action, what kind of impact would that have on pharmaceutical costs to the consumers just in general across the United States?
Well, Senator Thomas, via the chair, it is unclear as to long-term impact of the healthcare reform on pharmacy and specifically on PBM practices. However, I will say that while I have problems with large portions of the bill for other reasons, the PBM aspect, I think, is actually fairly positive in that there will be greater transparency required. The problem is the implementation time frame that we may be looking at 2014, 2015, 2016, and beyond, and also in the uniformity of the application, because in the exchange model that we foresee, every state potentially, or every region, depending on how those compacts are set up, will have some discretion as to how the vendors are selected and how, you know, what standards, the regulation of prices, and a whole bunch of other things. So I think it's incumbent upon each individual state, first of all, because we're talking about millions of dollars a year typically, not to wait, but to go ahead and put things in place that would protect you in the interim. And certainly if the exchange environment does not protect you long-term, you will have long-term protection through SB 38. And if the reconciliation bill goes into effect fully, then you haven't lost anything. You've just protected yourself in the interim years as it's being implemented.
Thank you.
Any additional questions from the committee? Mr. Purcell, we thank you very much for taking the time to provide your testimony to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We now have on the list Mr. Pat Shire, I understand, is available. Would you like to make any comments? Mr. Shire is, well, we'll let him identify himself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Pat Shire, serving as Director of the Division of Retirement and Benefits, and I'm available to answer any questions if senators have any.
You know, I would like to, I know we, the state of Alaska, has changed in the last year or so, and would like for you, if you could, to make a comment upon, you know, your perception of where we were, where we are, and where you think we might best be going.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. As you'll recall, our conversation in another committee, last year we were talking about a change transition to our new third-party administrator with Wells Fargo Insurance Services. And one of the things that we learned from some of the questions that were raised by some of the people here in the room back in 2008 actually helped us, I think, write a much better RFP. And one of the things that we demanded in that RFP is that we did not depend on scoring those programs based on shared discounts, either for drug or medical. You may or may not be aware that sharing discounts in network is also a common practice in the medical community. And based on that, we are currently in an arrangement with a pure TPA that is not an insurance company for health benefits that we pay on a per member per month basis for their claims paying services. Of course, we're self-insured both for the retiree and the active plan. It says Alaska Care on the card. And that's the similar arrangement we have with the Envision Costco partnership. There is no spread pricing, no rebate that is hidden and kept by the PBM. Any rebates that arise during the tenure of our relationship flow directly to the state. But we pay them simply on a per member, per month basis to manage our pharmacy benefit management. I think we're in a much better place than we were back in 2008.
Thank you, Mr. Shire. You know, the state plan does cover quite a large percentage of Alaskans, but just roughly what percentage is covered under this new system that is in place, and as compared to the percentage of Alaska that isn't covered?
Mr. Chairman, I would rather defer to a colleague here in the room who has a very nice pie chart that describes what percentage of the population is covered. I can tell you that we serve approximately 72,000 to 74,000 individuals, including members and dependents. And of those, some are retirees, about 52,000. We can back into it, I suppose. About 40% of those folks are outside the state of Alaska. For the active population, we're somewhere around 15,000 total individuals. And it's a moving target a bit, but those are my last recollections.
Do you have any suggestions to this committee on what, as a statewide policy, we might do to make sure that the issues that you've identified might be more broadly applied to protect all of Alaskans?
Mr. Chairman, you're the policymakers, and we would endeavor to bring to you the information that you need, and that was our effort in the material that we provided, and met with some of the independent pharmacists that are here in the room yesterday afternoon, had a very good discussion. They have brought some concerns to the table that we will look into. We've asked Buck Consultants to also refresh their analysis. But when we look at 19.6% increase in medical plan spend for the coming fiscal year, and also anticipate another 19.6%, we wish to move slowly and provide as best information we can, and we'll continue to do that.
Any questions of Mr. Shire, Senator Thomas?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Shire, just hearing what you've heard today and with your discussions with the pharmacists and your knowledge of the plan and the way it operates and your last RFP, does anything cause you to think you need to go back and revisit your last RFP, or are there some things you plan to do, or is there a way out or of anything, or do you think that the RFP was worded in such a manner that you've protected yourself from any of the things we've discussed here today?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomas, I think we're in much better shape. I think we're in very good shape. We have more Alaska pharmacists in the network today than we did under the prior plan. Envision Costco, under the leadership of Wells Fargo Insurance Services, is directed to negotiate those contracts. The individuals have an opportunity to negotiate, and we were very pleased when they reported back to us after their initial efforts that they were able to actually expand the number of in-network pharmacies. So that's a long way of saying that I believe we're in a pretty good place right now and very transparent. We prefer the per member per month model, both with our medical plan and our drug plan. So we're always willing to learn new things and improve services to our members. But at the time, we have no incentive to approach anything like a renegotiation.
If I could follow up.
Certainly. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is in your mind, then, is there a pharmacy benefit manager involved anywhere in the chain with the state of Alaska's prescription plan?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thomas, absolutely. Envision Costco is the partnership that is taking the role of a pharmacy benefit manager for the state of Alaska. Envision is the PBM, the pharmacy benefit manager. It's a fairly unique model in the industry that charges only a flat per member per month fee to manage those contracts. They provide a 24/7 call center for our members, which has been very popular. The fact that they can reach somebody with questions even on the weekends. The Costco partnership portion, they are the ones who deliver the mail order pharmacy piece, which is, I'm going from memory here, but I'll take a stab at it. It's about a third or less of the total number of scripts that are filled for the Alaska plan. But our members, many of our members desire the mail order convenience, and we have that available to them.
Okay, thank you.
Senator Meyer.
Yes, I'm trying to remember. Fortunately, it's been a while since I've got a prescription, but I think under the new plan, the Wells Fargo plan, you can both go to your pharmacy or you can order, do a mail order. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, absolutely.
Okay. And then, if I heard correctly this today, the mail order seems to be where the problems occur or may occur.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Meyer, under the old PBM process, I have heard complaints from pharmacists in particular that there may be no economies for steering individuals to the mail order. Economy is one of the considerations, convenience certainly the other. And my answer to that would be that there may be cases where the pricing does not provide economy, but our consultants, Buck consultants, consistently have told us, and in fact, since I've been involved in healthcare delivery for state employees back in from 1992, consistently we hear that the mail order option can be very valuable in whole, on average, maybe not in every case.
Okay, if I can follow up on that.
Sure.
That's good to know, because I can't remember. Sometimes I go to Fred Meyer's, sometimes I go to Carr's, and sometimes I do mail order. And I guess I really have not paid too much attention, because usually, you know, I just pay whatever the state doesn't pay, that I pay the balance. But it certainly, if there are one advantage to the state over another, whether it be mail order or, I don't know, going directly to Costco or, and I don't even think that there was any push to go generic or non-generic. And I would certainly think that there's some savings there as well. I just think that there's some things like this that we can do to save the state money and would be helpful.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, Senator Meyer, we do have steerage in the plan where we're able for generic, and actually the retirees have done a great job of increasing what's called their generic substitution rate. And we incent that actually in the active employee plan, where your copay is somewhat lower, if you talk with your provider about the availability and efficacy of generics.
Yeah, certainly not all drugs allow you to go generic. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Senator Meyer. Any further questions of Mr. Shire? Seeing none, we thank you.
Thank you.
Is the person with the pie chart, is that Linda Hall? Is that we would welcome. I'm taking a wild guess.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Linda Hall, Director of the Division of Insurance. And this is one of the few hearings I did not bring my pipe. Senator Davis has multiple colored copies of it. With that aside, I can't remember the part with the state that Mr. Shire referred to. I really use it for the part of the industry that we regulate, which is 23%. But there is a large chunk of that pie chart that represents self-insureds, as well as the uninsureds, the Medicaid, Medicare populations. The total self-insured population is probably 40%, significantly higher than the regulated piece of the private insurance market, so I would say probably 40% of the pie chart, but that includes all self-insured programs, not just the state.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a significant number. And if there are any other questions about the pie chart, I'll deliver one to you too. I would like to make just a couple very brief comments.
Please
do. Senate Bill 38 is in my title, so it would be something that the Division of Insurance would regulate and would enforce should it be enacted into legislation. The first 12 pages, I think there's been some misunderstanding about. So it takes care of 12 out of 21 pages, so you can get, you know, beyond that. The first 12 pages really are something we added to this bill. We worked with the original bill sponsor, Senator Elton, and those 12 pages merely make a terminology change. We have substituted healthcare insurer for managed care entity. It makes it consistent with the rest of our health insurance regulation. It doesn't change any provision of any of those particular portions of our title. So 12 pages are merely a terminology change. So the concentration can start at the bottom of page 12. I think it's appropriate to do some oversight of pharmacy benefit managers. That's been discussed here at great length. I think you will find, as you listen to various sides of the argument, I think there's no question that some regulation or oversight is warranted. A registration system was mentioned as a positive in this bill, and I agree that that's the way we would think that these entities should be regulated, not through the licensing process we do with certain entities that we regulate, but through a registration process. And we have modeled much of what's in this bill as third-party administrators. I can tell you today that there are several PBMs who are actually registered as third-party administrators in our state. So some are following that model already and registering. I think in the bill, and Senator French and I have discussed this bill at various times, both last year and this year, there are a number of the provisions that I think need revision. I did not prepare, nor do I think you want to hear from me today, a laundry list of what I think needs to be changed in this bill. But I do think that there are things that need to be revised. I think there are reporting requirements that go beyond anything that's useful. Couple things that I would just mention briefly. I don't want to approve the contracts between the PBM and whoever it may be, and I think we're missing a big segment of who the PBMs serve, and that's health insurers. The focus of most of the presentation I've seen today has actually been on self-insured plan, governmental agencies, but PBMs also work on behalf of health insurers, which is probably a portion that we're more familiar with than the self-insureds. So that is another segment of the world in which the PBMs operate. I don't think it's appropriate that the division necessarily, I don't think they should, approve the contracts between the PBM and the entity. In all other cases, between health insurers and providers, between TPAs and those for whom they may facilitate claims payments, we set standards for what can be in an agreement, and we have standards in TPA agreements now. But we set general standards. We do not approve each individual contract. I might have to put a fiscal note on the bill if I had to do that, which I haven't done to date. There are disclosure forms, various, particularly to the end user, to the consumer who gets a prescription. There's a requirement for a disclosure form, which I think is fine. I think the consumer has a right to know that there's a middle person in this equation. However, the bill provides that each of those signed disclosure forms come to the Division of Insurance. I really don't want all that paper. I think a copy of the generic disclosure form would be adequate, or maybe an approved disclosure form that we do. We've actually done that for prescription forms. We have approved prescription forms because nobody else seemed to want to, so it fell to us. But there's an amount of record keeping that I think is not efficient or really cost effective. Some of the pieces of the legislation duplicate processes we already have. I've heard complaint issues. Where do you go? How do you do a complaint if I have a complaint against a PBM? We already have a fairly extensive complaint process in our title. We take complaints. We have actually a whole complaint section in our division, and that's what they do. They deal with consumer complaints, and we have formal processes by which complaints can be filed and heard. And so we have that. We already have fees and penalties in our statute that I don't like to see duplication of things that we already do. I don't think it's efficient for any agency to set up a whole new way to regulate a little individual piece of it. We regulate thousands of individuals. And I think we have methods in place to regulate that we don't need to set up a new one just for PBMs. So there are things like that I would like to, I would hope would be looked at, and I would certainly plan to work with the bill sponsor on those issues. We have had those discussions, and with that I would stop and take any questions that you may have.
We thank you, Ms. Hall, for that. And as I announced at the beginning, it is my intent to set it aside so that some of this work we can be explored to see if we can't make it the right fit for Alaska. Any questions that anyone has of Linda Hall? Seeing none, we thank you.
Thank you.
We do understand that there's a Rose Calamarides.
Yes, I'm here.
Please state your name and affiliation and provide your testimony. And we are running a little bit late, so try to keep it precise.
I will. Okay, my name is Rose Calamarides. I'm the administrator of the Alaska Teamster Trust Funds. And I've been in that capacity since 1996. I'm going to testify against Senate Bill 38 today. We did submit a letter earlier that outlined some of our concerns, so I won't belabor those. But I did want to explain that the Teamsters hired a pharmacy benefit manager in 1994. It was one of the first, we were one of the first large groups in the state, maybe the only one, or the earliest to hire a PBM. So we've been through all the gyrations. In 2006, we put a bid out, an RFP out, for a transparent contract. And so all the things that these pharmacists today have described, there's a lot of truth in there. There's a lot of problems with the PBMs and these AWP and their average wholesale pricing and all that, and all the hidden charges and the way they rebate the money back to the clients. We have gone beyond that, just like the state of Alaska has recently with their Costco and Vision contract, and we have a transparent contract with our PBM. In fact, when we put it out to bid, we had about five respondents, and the two runner-ups, Costco and Vision, was the second runner-up, only because their network hadn't been expanded enough in the state. And so our current transparent contract is working well. We don't see the need for this legislation. We think it will only increase costs for our participants.
All right, thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Rose, for your testimony. How do you anticipate the increased costs for your members or whoever you said it would be?
Well, one of the things in this is it looks like that any willing provider legislation that was introduced a few years ago with, for medical services, and it looks like if we have a mail order service, which we do, of course, our PBM does, and 10% of our pharmaceuticals go through that mail order, and we save a lot of money because of that, and our retirees outside love the service. It looks like we wouldn't have any kind of control if a participant wanted to go to a pharmacy, they get the same pricing. It looks like it would just shift money into the local pharmacy's pockets. But we're paying our pharmacy or our PBM not a per member per month like the state, but we're paying them a per script fee, and then we're paying for the acquisition prices. And so this just looks like it's going to force us to do business a little differently. It looks like it's trying to regulate some of the programs we have in place right now, like our step therapy programs and our formularies. And I think it mixes into our private business, and I don't think that's the state's job.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions? Seeing none, we thank you for your testimony. Dave Dedurix, we welcome you. I briefly was introduced before we went on the record, but
Mind if Cindy comes up with me as well?
Cindy Lobacher? Yes.
Lobacher.
Sir, if you could both please state your names and affiliation and provide your testimony.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. My name is Dave Dedurix, and I work with Express Scripts. We're a pharmacy benefits manager. We're based out of St. Louis, Missouri. We manage the prescription drug benefit for 75 million Americans. And this year, we will handle and process 750 million prescriptions for people across this country. Our clients include health insurers, Fortune 500 companies, labor unions, state governments and as well as the federal government. In fact, our largest contract is with the United States Department of Defense. So we provide all the prescription drug benefits for our servicemen and women. What we do is we drive out waste in the healthcare industry. We actually make money when our clients save money. That's one of the things we try to do. We try to reduce waste and lower costs. And I'm going to just give you a few examples of what we do, because you'll see that it stands in direct contradiction to a lot of the testimony that you've heard today. First and foremost, we try to promote generics. They are FDA approved and they are AMA endorsed. They are significantly cheaper than brand name pharmaceuticals. In fact, 2 years ago, a study came out that said the average cost of a brand name drug was $120, and for the same generic, the average cost was $34. So you can see that there is a significant dichotomy in terms of price. Now, earlier today in the testimony, you heard that a lot of times PBMs switch drugs to get the brand name drugs into people's prescriptions so that we can get money back on rebates, and I'm here to tell you that's absolutely false. In fact, of the 750 million prescriptions that we will process this year, over 68% of them will be generic drugs. If it were true that we are switching drugs to brand name drugs to make money on rebates, we wouldn't dispense 68% of our drugs as generics. It just doesn't make sense. I'm not ashamed to say this, we're a for-profit company. We make more money when we use generic drugs, when we can get people to save money by utilizing lower cost, safe FDA-approved drugs, we make more money. We also negotiate discounts with brand manufacturers, and this is going to be important for you to understand because this goes in direct contradiction to the disclosure requirements in this bill. When we have a pharmacy and therapeutics committee determine which drugs should not possibly be included on our formulary, we'll give them a list. No financials will be included. We will give them a list of drugs to evaluate for efficacy and efficiency. And then what we will do is we'll take that whole list and we will go out to all the different brand name drug manufacturers and we will have them give them our best price, or their best price, to be put on our formulary. As I mentioned, we provide the drugs for 75 million Americans, so there's a pretty strong incentive for them to give us their best price because they want to be included on our formulary. If we have to disclose all this financial information, it's going to destroy the incentive for them to give us their best price, because if they find out that company X is giving us $42, then they only have to bid $41.99. It completely destroys incentives and it doesn't allow the free market to help dictate what contract terms are. Also, if you want to look at this, you can. You don't need to, but I printed these up for you. These are five separate letters. These aren't just anecdotal stories like you heard earlier. These are five separate letters written by the Federal Trade Commission on disclosure legislation that has been heard in New Jersey, California, the District of Columbia, Virginia, and Albany, New York. And universally, I tabbed and highlighted each one of these letters if you want to see it. The FTC, a nonpartisan group out of Washington, has said disclosure requirements destroy competition. It allows for collusion among brand name manufacturers to increase their prices, and it will hurt consumers. So I just wanted to tell you about disclosure requirements in here. We also create networks of retail pharmacies, and we also manage formularies for our clients. And finally, another area that we save money is through mail order. Now, mail order is really important to us, but you need to understand it's only about 10% of the scripts that we dispense. And in fact, this is important because what we can do at mail order, and this is only for maintenance medications. So if you have a chronic condition, we will suggest as your PBM to the employer or the health plan that is insuring you that mail order is a good way to save money on drugs, because you can get a 90-day supply for two co-payments instead of paying three co-payments for three 30-day supplies at your retail pharmacy. So we're incentivizing you to pay less to get a bigger supply. Now, studies also show that when you take 90-day supplies on mail order medications, your adherence rate goes up, and so your overall health improves because you are taking your drugs more frequently. So we can save money, we can help people's adherence rates, and we can also utilize generics more when we use mail order pharmacies. So those are some of the ways that we save people money. I have pages and pages of testimony written for you, but I'm not going to go into them. I just want to respond to a few other things that were mentioned in, with previous testifiers, so I apologize. I will not go on much longer. It was stated earlier that we are a largely unregulated industry, and I just want to let you know that's categorically untrue. We are regulated by the Alaska State Medicaid Agency in charge of Medicaid. We are registered with the Alaska State Board of Pharmacy and regulated by them. We are also subject to regulation, as you heard, from the State Division of Insurance, part of the Department of Commerce. We are regulated by the Federal Trade Commission, the United States Department of Labor, the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, as well as the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. We are a highly regulated industry, and we don't need any more regulations, in our opinion. You said that there's been a rapid spending increase in drugs, and that actually isn't true. There has been a rapid increase in people's overall medical spend in the past couple decades. It's true, and a lot of it's medical. But actually, because we have been able to introduce some of these tools, like drug utilization review, introducing generics into the pipeline, as well as getting people to take mail order services from us, people's drug spend has actually decreased year to year over the last 3 years because of what we have been able to do in terms of drug management tools. You also heard that transparency is going to be important for our plan sponsors, but I just want to make it aware to you that there is not one single plan sponsor, health insurer, or employer that's here in front of you today in support of this bill. It's only the Pharmacy Association and pharmacists. There is not one client of ours that's here that supports these type of measures, and that's because our clients are very sophisticated purchasers. You heard Mr. Shire speak about how they have a consultant. The labor unions, the Fortune 500 companies, the government agencies, they hire consultants to help them negotiate these contracts with us. There's over 60 PBMs in this country, so it's a very competitive industry. If we won't meet the terms and conditions that are set out for us by our clients in their RFP process, we just simply won't get their business. And our contracts are only for 3 years. So you're going to see a high turnover if you're not meeting the demands of your specific clients and their unique needs. This bill is riddled with mandates for contracts that we would rather see regulated by the free market. Each one of our clients has a unique population set, a unique set of people with their own unique medication needs, not necessarily that would be helped by this type of legislation. Earlier it was mentioned that in New York there was transparency legislation for a PBM. And I would submit, or not that there was legislation, but there was a contract with the New York State contract with their PBM for transparency. And you also heard your own Mr. Shire tell you that he has transparency. I would submit to you there's no need for legislation that requires transparency if the market is already dictating that if that's what you'd like in your contract, that's what you probably will receive. It's just that companies like mine probably just won't submit RFPs for your business. So, finally, Senator Thomas, earlier you just asked about whether or not we touch drugs. We are a non-resident pharmacy, so we do ship drugs into your state, so we do, as a non-resident mail order pharmacy, do touch drugs on occasion. And with that, I'll conclude my testimony.
Thank you. We welcome Cindy Laubacher.
Laubacher, thank you very much. Cindy Laubacher, Senior Director of State Government Affairs for Medco Health Solutions. Medco is the is one of the top three you've heard about today. We have approximately 60 million members across the country, with in the state of Alaska, approximately 155,000 residents are Medco members. Again, as Dave said, you know, since we're going to be talking about this over the course of the interim and all, I won't go into all of the various parts. Dave covered most of those pretty well, but I do want to reiterate and touch on a couple of things based on questions from committee members. First of all, as was stated by Mr. Purcell on the phone, and he made my case for why this bill is unnecessary. State of New Jersey recently awarded Medco the new PBM contract. It is a transparent contract. They, as Mr. Purcell said, you know, Mr. Purcell is arguing that we're going to, the state's going to save $500 million. State of New Jersey does not have this bill in place. State of New Jersey did not need Senate Bill 38 or any other bill in order to get the kinds of savings that they were looking for. And we're very proud to, as a New Jersey-based company, to have won that contract. With regard to the statement that 23 states have this and that you would simply be joining those other 23 states with transparency legislation, that's incorrect. One state in the District of Columbia have passed legislation similar to this in terms of disclosure, fiduciary, and transparency. The state of Maine and the District of Columbia. This District of Columbia, that's being litigated and is not in effect. In the state of Maine, that was upheld by the courts. It was litigated extensively, upheld, and we are not writing most of the large PBMs are no longer writing new business in that state. Bottom line is clients can ask for anything they want. That's what the RFP process is for. They can ask for as much transparency as they want or don't want. If you've seen one RFP, you've seen one RFP. No two clients want the same thing. So we would argue in that regard that this bill is not necessary. I'm particularly concerned about, and I want to clarify the record with regard to margins. I don't know where they come up with those numbers. The SEC would be very interested to find out we're making 40 to 65% since we're required by law to report quarterly to the SEC what it is our profits are and show all those numbers. And our numbers show that PBM profits at Medcos in particular are in the 2% or less. So I'm greatly concerned that you not walk away thinking the PBM industry is operating with 40 to 55% margins. That is absolutely incorrect, and you only need to go to the SEC filings to see those numbers. With regard to one last question that was raised by a committee member was with regard to federal health care reform. Medco prides itself on being a transparent company. We support transparency. We supported the Senate language that was recently enacted and signed into law by the president. So that you understand, we do consider ourselves a transparent company, and there is transparency language in the federal bill, and we did support that bill. And with that, I'll reserve for questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We are running short on time today, so I do want to get to the other people that have signed up as witnesses, but I would request, I don't want the entire SEC filing, but if you could provide to my staff the SEC filing, and then you indicated, Mr.
Dietrichs,
there we go, that you had some letters, and so if you would like, you can provide them to my staff, and I will distribute those as we do, and any information that witnesses want to distribute to the committee. So I do welcome that opportunity if you so choose. So we do thank you for your testimony today. We have Greg Loudon, Anchorage, online.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Please state your name and affiliation, and please be brief.
I'm an employee benefits consultant employed by Parker Smith and Feek, a local insurance broker here in Anchorage. I'm here today on behalf of the Alaska Association of Health Underwriters, which is a consumer protection and trade group for brokers and agents. We just wanted to register our opposition to this bill as written. Similar to Ms. Hall, we have a number of concerns with the legislation for a lot of the same reasons you've heard today. In short, we just believe this is an unnecessary restraint of trade. It eliminates a number of cost containment options for our clients, both insured and self-insured groups. We think that there's a valuable service provided by the pharmacy benefit managers, and we think that there are market solutions to any errors that happen to be in the provision of services. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Loudon. As I indicated earlier, we do not intend to move it, so we have received your opposition. We now go to Sally Stuvek. Is Sally Stuvek available?
Yes, I am. Good afternoon.
Please state your name and affiliation and be as brief as possible.
I sure will. Thank you very much for taking my testimony. My name is Sally Stuvek, and I'm the Human Resources Director for the Fairbanks North Star Borough, where I have oversight for both the boroughs and the school district self-insured health insurance plans. Both the borough and the school district are active members currently in the Healthcare Cost Management Corporation of Alaska, and as a result, we have seen strong savings in health plan costs by their ability to negotiate agreements with providers. The prescription benefit relationship through the HCC-CMA has been able to negotiate with our current vendor to provide significant savings to all of our member partners, and we would like to be able to continue that arrangement. We believe that this legislation, SB 38, appears to jeopardize our ability to continue those cost-saving relationships and that we would need in order to continue to manage our health claim costs. We are still reviewing and evaluating the legislation, and I'm pleased to hear that it's not going to move forward today. but we did want to just briefly take our this opportunity to raise our concerns regarding the section of the legislation that restricts the ability of the employer or group of employers to work together to negotiate discounts on our behalf. The PBM provides a valuable service to our health plan by reducing those costs not only to the employer-sponsored health plans, but also to the employees. Our preliminary estimates, if we were not able to have this relationship or a similar relationship, would have an impact of up to in excess of $3 million per year, which would have a devastating budget impact, you know, for our local group. So I, again, thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'm pleased to hear that that there will be additional work on this legislation before it moves forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Sally Stuvek. I believe that is the entire list of the people that have signed up. So with that, we will close testimony on Senate Bill 38 at this time, and we are, it is my intent to set it aside. So with that, we'll move on to the next Senate bill, which we're going to go get a little out of order here. The bill that I would hope to move forward is Senate Bill 303, the Workers' Compensation Bill. This was originally addressed a week ago, and I hope that the committee members have had the opportunity to review the bill. It is really just an undo of what was done a number of years ago. In the state, we had a system that adequately operated from statehood for approximately 45 years, and then the system was changed, and I think in an improper manner. And as I explained the last time, I think that this is the right policy for the state of Alaska. Mr. Stepp, did you have anything that you wanted to present? There is a legal services memo that does indicate the extent of what I think the injustice is that someone, even with criminal negligence, that if they were operating with a gross deviation from the standard of care, that they would be immune, as the law currently is, from responsibility or accountability for their conduct. And I think that generally people, when they hear that someone could be criminally negligent in their conduct and not be accountable for it, that they are troubled by that. We have with us today Trina Hykus. She presented to this committee the last time, and I think was very helpful to the committee. If there's Ms. Hykus, if you would please come forward. There possibly may be questions that...
Hi, my name is Trina Hykus. I'm the director of the Division of Workers' Compensation. Do any of the members have any questions for me about the bill?
Yes. Senator Meyer.
Just a couple, and I think I understand the bill. I still can't remember why it got changed. And you indicated that you weren't here in 2004 when this got changed. But I wonder. Was there some concern, and does this bill rectify double dipping by a victim? In other words, can the victim who gets injured, can they sue the subcontractor who they're working for, and also sue the general who hired the subcontractor?
They could never sue their employer. The exclusiveness of liability for an employer is still in effect under this bill, and as it has been since workers' compensation systems were first developed at the turn of the century. So there would be no double dipping vis-a-vis the employer and employee. And if they sued the general contractor, their recovery would be offset under AS 2330.015 by the employer's lien, and that lien is equal to the amount of workers' compensation benefits that the employer has paid, less the employer's pro rata share of attorney's fees, and that's per a Supreme Court decision. So there is an offset for workers' comp from the tort recovery under a different statute, AS 2330.015.
Okay. I'm going to do this again. I think we did this last time. I apologize for being so dense, but if Senator Pascopan is the general contractor, he hires me as the subcontractor, and I, you know, I'm delinquent in providing a safe working environment, and the employee who's working for me gets injured, that employee can come back to me and Senator Pascopan, or just me, the subcontractor?
If you're insured for workers' compensation, your insurance carrier would provide benefits to that injured worker. If you were uninsured, then under the statute, as it now reads and as it would read with 303, the general contractor would be liable for the workers' compensation benefits. As the statute now reads, if the general contractor was the tortfeasor, you couldn't sue the general contractor or the project owner.
Okay.
And you can never sue your employer, period, unless they're uninsured. If they're uninsured for workers' comp, then you lose, understandably, the benefits of workers' comp, which is the exclusive liability.
I think I got it. But why would a general contractor hire a sub who didn't have insurance?
Well, that's a good question. That's, I think, the law under 045, as it now reads, and as it will read after if 303 were passed, it behooves a contractor. In fact, it places responsibility on them to be very careful and make sure those subs are carrying workers' comp, because otherwise their carrier is going to be on the hook.
Okay. So, if I may, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
I think I'm on a roll. I think I'm understanding this.
It's the right thing, Senator
Meyer.
Okay,
good. So, apparently, maybe in the past what was happening was that the sub was able to do the work cheaper or less expensive because they didn't have the insurance.
Through the chair, Senator Myers, that's correct. If a subcontractor is not carrying, just like any employer, if they're not carrying workers' comp, they're at an advantage in a bidding situation because I'm not carrying that cost. It's not an expense to me.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Senator Myers. I do believe that we have two people who've signed up at the Anchorage LIO to testify. Would they please come forward and state their name and affiliation and try to limit it to 2 minutes?
Hello, my name is Keith Montgomery. I want to thank you. I'm a representative with the Alaska Regional Council of Partners. I'm here to testify and support on House Senate Bill 303 and act related to subcontractors and project owners' liability for workers' comp. This bill is the start of what is a bigger problem that affects the construction industry as a whole. Last year, I testified on House Bill 22. Both bills have a piece of the puzzle correct, but with many holes and missing puzzle pieces, such as independent subcontractors and tier subcontractors.
Are you there?
Yes, I am. Sorry.
Okay.
This is a bigger problem in our industry. The real issue is to close the loopholes that level the playing field and protect the construction industry and the Alaskan workers, and stop labor brokers that refuse to take personal responsibility for workers that get hurt on jobs, phasing out what kind of subcontractor does the work, because it's not going to cover the whole thing. Recently, I spoke to a contractor working on a state construction project that says the reason I tier subcontractors have many levels where these workers don't provide workers' comp, and you ask why would a contractor hire these guys? It's because they can come in 30% lower on the bid and get the job. So you have a sub of a sub of a sub that has no workers' comp. He directs the work. They're actually employees of the subcontractor, but each person carries a business license. This contractor told me the reason he tier subcontracts in the state of Alaska is because you can get away with it. That Alaska laws are real weak.
Thank you, Mr. Montgomery. I take it you support Senate Bill 303.
Yes, I do, and I'd like to see it moved out of committee. Thank you.
Thank you. Was there one other person from Anchorage LIO?
Yes, two other.
One other that just joined us that just signed up.
All right, because we do have a very short time fuse here, so if you could just state your name, affiliation, and whether you support or oppose, and if necessary, a brief reason why.
Okay, my name is Scott Hansen. I am with Carpenters Local 1281 here in Anchorage. In our construction industry, the use of subcontracting, independent contracting, and tier contracting has become totally out of control. We on a daily basis receive information on tier contracting 3 to 4 levels deep, where these employees, as I call them, are not under workers' comp policy, anywhere past the general contractor or the first-level subcontractor. This is very detrimental to legitimate subcontractors and give a huge advantage to the subcontractor who in turn hires these independent tier contractors. There's a high percentage of these independent contractors working up subs to the subs to the subs. They are truly working in every definition of it as an employee. They are required to show up to work certain hours, work off other contractors' equipment. They do not supply any materials and have no risk for loss. General contractors should be scared to death of the possibility of independent contractors working out on their job. Sole proprietors without any employees. I believe Senate Bill 303 is a start in controlling this situation and will help future legislation in protecting legitimate contractors. Also helping solve the abuse on 1099 issues, tax evasion, and the non-reporting problems in the prevailing wage reporting. Thank you very much, and I hope this passes through.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Chris Gregg is the last person who has signed up. If you could please state your name and affiliation.
This is Chris Gregg. I'm a business manager for the Painters and Allied Trades. This bill, I am in favor of the passage of this bill. It is affecting my contractors immensely. They have a 22 to 25% bidder disadvantage for providing workman's comp for their employees, and it's become common business practice to subcontract all your work to avoid workman's comp, Social Security, and unemployment insurance. This bill needs to move on. It's a start. It's not the complete answer. If we get no action on this bill, you can kiss legitimate contractors goodbye because they can't compete with this loophole available to unscrupulous business owners to misclassify their employees as owner-operators. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gregg. I believe that is the extent of the people that have signed up to testify, so I will close public comment on that. Is there any discussion? You know, I know Senator Meyer, you were indicating you may have some issues. I guess from my perspective, I can say that there is absolutely no double dipping. That's just not the way the system is set up. If there is a recovery, the workers' comp is reimbursed, and it's allocation according to fault. So if one is 25% at fault, you know, that's what our system is right now. If there's any discussion, Senator Thomas.
Just a comment to make sure I understand, and I'm not sure exactly the genesis of the bill either. Then I believe some people were killed on a particular job, and that led to some changes because they, I'm not sure whether the subcontractor had workers' comp or not. It almost sounds like if they did, that would have been the only recovery, but it seems to me there was something a little more complex in the play at the time that allowed the, or potentially allowed the owner, not just a general contractor, but an owner to be sued, basically, because they had been negligent in the performance of their duties, or at least maybe it was a general for them, but negligent in their duties as they prepared a workplace, which they required, or they had the authority to do it. They did not rely on someone else to do it. And it seems to me that there it was a little more than just the ability for workers' comp to be in place. But as we're looking at it today anyhow, that it appears that some subs don't purchase workers' comp. The generals don't require them to do what they're supposed to do, which is post the proof of their workers' comp, or at least give them a copy of their binder, exactly. And so therefore, in an attempt to make sure that people are protected and that maybe the generals are protected themselves more, from themselves almost, that one of the only ways to do it is to implement a law that allows them to be held responsible if, in fact, they're not going to hold their subcontractors responsible for having workers' comp. I don't know if that gets too convoluted or not, but that's kind of my understanding of how the thing's going now. Okay. Thank you.
Given that, I would entertain a motion with respect to Senate Bill 303.
Mr. Chairman, I would move Senate Bill, let's see, it's just a regular Senate bill. We don't have a committee substitute, or do we?
No.
No. Senate Bill 303 from the Labor Committee with the individual recommendations and the attached zero fiscal note.
Any objection there too? Seeing none, it is so moved. And with that, I guess I will sign, but while we're signing, we did not get the opportunity to bring Senate Bill 304, which is the Model Entities Transaction Act, before us, but we do, it was not my intent to move that bill today, because I, in deference to the Department of Law and all of the people that have been working hard on it, there are some issues that do need to be addressed, and I think it's probably very much more appropriate to deal with that over the interim. So just so everyone understands where we're going, we're going to hold the Model Entities Transaction Act and present that next year is my intent. So with that, I will conclude Senate Labor and Commerce for this Thursday, April 1.